I so much appreciate you doing a special Saturday night interview with us.
I'm starving at the time being, but we're going to do an hour.
Okay. Well, let's get her done here, man. Great to have you on the program. Man, you are a near legend concerning this 411 series that you put together. I have watched these videos. We have the book. It's mesmerizing to listen to these stories, and the way you present them is so professional. But I want you to tell the audience here how you got started even in looking into missing persons.
Well, I was a policeman for 20 years, and then I started to write some books. And I was at a national park doing some peripheral research, and a couple of park rangers were following me around, and it was a little odd. But I wasn't there to interview them. I was there to interview some of the people, the contractors working at the park. At the end of the day, when I came off the property, went to my lodge, I got a knock on the door. It's one of these rangers in plain clothes. And they told me that they had worked at a series of parks in the past, and they had experienced missing people. They had investigated some missing people. And they thought that it was kind of strange that for 7 to 10 days while the person was missing, there was a lot of activity. There's a big search effort, et cetera. And then at the end of 7 to 10 days, everything stopped. And they said that they had experienced this at the other parks that they had worked at. And they kind of came together at this one park, and they started to share each other's details. And they figured out that they had essentially experienced the same thing at two different locations. And when they went in and tried to find details from the park service themselves, they were thwarted in their efforts, and they couldn't get it. And they came to me and they said, you know, you have investigative experience and you've written some books, so you're probably the perfect guy to go out and look into this. Mm-hmm. So the next day I left, called a couple of friends of mine in law enforcement, told them what I heard, and I asked them, hey, is there anything to this? A couple hours later they called me back and they said, wow, there's a lot of people missing in national parks. It's worth a look. It's kind of how it all got started.
Wow. Now, looking for people, did you look for people, missing persons, as a uniformed officer?
I can't say that I did much of that. I worked in a lot of proactive units. I was working on a couple task forces, worked vice intelligence for a long time, worked street crimes unit, patrol, was a detective in a couple of different divisions, but specifically missing people. Only one case I ever really worked, and that was a polyclass case out in Petaluma, California.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I'll tell you what. You've written a number of books. What was your first book about? I mean, what was it going to say from the first book as you sort of progressed? You had a series of books, and you started getting into video. So how did you sort of coalesce those into additional information books? So, did you do it by category or just by feeling or by the number of accounts you were getting?
You know, at the beginning, I had this number of cases, and I didn't quite know what to do with it. I filed a series of Freedom of Information Act requests against the Park Service trying to get more details on some of these, and they came back and they would tell me, well, we don't have any lists of missing people in those parks, because that's what I wanted, so I could then look at the cases specifically. And I said, well, that can't be. I mean, you guys have a huge National Park Police Force. They're trained at the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center in Virginia. They're trained really well. So I know they understand the importance of keeping a list of missing people. They came back twice and said that they didn't have any. And I said, well, okay, I'm a published author. I'm going to use a Freedom of Information Act exemption for you to go out and get that number of those lists. 6 weeks later, an attorney from the Park Service calls me and said, well, you don't qualify for the exemption because your books aren't in enough libraries, which that is not in the Freedom of Information Act. Mm-hmm. And so that really got a lot of law enforcement guys and me peeved. And so we just started to go out and accumulate numbers on our own, going through archive news articles. So at the beginning, I had maybe 250 cases from the East Coast and the West Coast of the U.S., and I put it together, and what I decided to do was to split the books. And I made one missing 411 East and missing 411 Western U.S., put it up on our website, Can-Am, like Canadian American, canammissing.com, and that's how I originally broke it up and started.
Yeah, wow. And, you know, now do you have a team that works with you, or how do you, how's that all go? I mean, it seems like you got a lot of information to deal with.
A lot of information. And as we've gotten larger, I get cases almost daily from different parts of the world. So yeah, there's people I talk to daily about this, and people that I trust, and people much smarter than I, about how we're supposed to move forward on this and how we kind of work the information and the statistics behind it.
Mm-hmm. Now, you do obviously get some hoaxes. Some people call you up and you know, or try to communicate with you that maybe perhaps want to use you or what you do. How do you sort of weed through them? How do you handle those when they come to you?
Yeah, I really don't get much of that. I probably the one group I get some of that from is psychics that say they want to work with us. And the way I handle that is I tell them, well, I'll send you one of my books. And there's enough information in there for you to go out and do your work. And you find me one of those people, I'll make you a superstar. And that was 8 years ago I started doing that. And to this day, nobody's been found.
Wow. Wow. And you also, you deal with some harrowing experiences, I imagine, talking to people and they're pouring their heart out to you and you maybe see them crying and stuff. I mean, how do you console somebody that, you know, you're there to help, you're researching, you know, maybe you'll find some clues in the process, but when they reach out for help, how do you console somebody that missed somebody that you know will never be found?
You know, I wear my emotions on my sleeve as well. I mean, I'm not a real heart and soul. And I can tell you that I've written some stories and I've walked out of my office at night crying because I feel for the parents. I have a daughter and a son. They're older now, but the thought of losing them in the mountains, search and rescue, you know, given a 7 to 10 day effort, then give it up, and me expecting, or the parents expecting to just leave that location forever and give up themselves. Many times the parents will stay there 2, 3, 4 weeks after the search and rescue have given up because they can't live with themselves. And I've made a lot of good friends from some of these people because I think they understand that I care a lot. And it bothers me a lot that some of the attitude of some of the people that are involved in search and rescue, it's horrible.
I know there's a few people that have sort of tried to appropriate your missing things, and I see you know, just a Google search, there's others out there. I mean, you know, that, and that's really unfortunate too, because you've been the leader in this field, and others, of course, that would happen with anything. There's always somebody trying to capitalize on that. But man, you put together a fascinating sort of things that happen, or the similarities to each of your cases. You show that in your books and in your movies. You say that there's similarities, and I imagine over time you've grouped these similarities together, and you've almost come to with a composite of what those are. And I think you suggest that these similarities are almost in every case. Can you talk about those similarities?
So if you read 5 or 10 missing persons cases, and there might be a couple of things in there in common. You read 500, and all of a sudden, certain things are starting to come out. You read 5,000, and now you can, I had stacks all over my living room where I had stacked up cases where canines couldn't find a scent, or a victim was found in or near water, or in or near a boulder field. Or immediately as they were disappearing, or as search and rescue was started, there was a weather event. Those are some of the most common ones. But you brought up a really good point about people mimicking my work and impersonating me. If you go onto YouTube, and there's a YouTube channel saying they are me, David Politis, it's a fraud and a hoax. There's another channel called Missing 411, a fraud and a hoax. 90% of the time, it's not even me on the channel talking. But the channel on YouTube that's ours is Can-Am Missing Project. That's the only channel I'm affiliated with. If you look on Twitter, I have a Twitter account, David Politis at Can-Am Missing. That's the only Twitter account we have. So it's a big issue that people have tried to ride our shoulders and ride our work to get views, to get paid on YouTube, et cetera. It's frustrating. Mm-hmm. But the profile points are consistent. And probably the issue we had is we sat around and we talked about how we can get the public become more aware of our work. And there's certain people that don't want to read books. Unfortunately, there's not a lot of people anymore reading books. So what we decided to do was to make a movie. And the first movie, Missing 411, was about a series of little boys that disappeared in or near national parks. And at the time, Les Stroud was a good friend. And he said, Dave, if I can ever do anything for you, you know, let me do it. So he volunteered to do some work where trying to replicate a trail of a missing two-year-old that disappeared in Oregon and was found 12 hours later, 9 miles away, and two mountain ranges later. In the middle of the night, with the crew around him, Les said, hey, forget it. I can't do this. This little boy didn't do it. Well, we know the boy did it. How he did it or what helped him, we have no idea. But the reality of it is there's dozens and dozens of those cases in that first movie and in the second movie that are unexplainable.
You mentioned boulders quite a bit, and that's fascinating about that. I'm going to shoot you my crazy. You don't go into speculation at all, but I mean I do because I'm the Cosmic Cowboy. So if you got a hat like this, you can speculate. You know, so you can't because you don't got this hat. But boulders in ancient lore. Boulders always have some spiritual significance, like with Indians and ancient civilizations. They almost, you know, they carved in them, they worshiped the various things like that. Is it possible that there's something with these boulders that's more than just rock, that's some supernatural entryway, perhaps?
Well, so in a 90 to 100 minute movie, we can only cover so many cases and talk about so many things. And if we cover too many things, then we get racked because we didn't go into detail, and if we cover too many things in detail, then we didn't cover enough cases. Folks, that's why we have the books. And to your point exactly, in one of my books, I talked about Iceland. And Iceland has lore that talks about fairies and little people that live in big boulders. And to this day, Iceland will not blow up or destroy a giant boulder to build a road. They'll put the road around the boulder because of those beliefs. So I'm somebody, I've written about that. I've written about fairies and other things in Native American lore. I won't ignore it. I will talk about it because I do believe that all of these things are here for a reason. And most, when you look into the background of a lot of Native American lore, there's an ounce of truth to it because in many other continents, they have the same stories as we have here in North America. Mm-hmm.
First movie, you open up with Dior Kunz, age 2. Can you tell us about that story right there, the case?
Yeah, so as we were going out on that movie, the Kunz case was evolving, and so we thought we'll jump on it. We're gonna track that. And Dior was a little 2-year-old boy. They went with his parents and his granddad and some friends way up into the mountains in Idaho. And the parents were down at this little creek, and Dior was with them, and he said, hey, I want to go back to Grandpa. And the mom and the dad kind of walked up the creek bed, and they last saw him walking towards the grandfather. And the grandfather was there waiting for him. Well, something happened there. The grandfather was older. He said the boy never made it to him. The parents said they turned and walked back to the creek as the boy was walking towards the grandpa. They called search and rescue, giant search. There's a lot of people who really attacked us because we put that story in. Well, they brought canines up there. Canines couldn't find a scent. It's in a wilderness area. And when you look at that story, still Dior hasn't been found. It's been years now, and nobody's ever been arrested. When you look at that story and you really understand it, either everybody at that scene was involved in Dior's disappearance and cover-up, or it's a real whodunit. And that's the real mystery behind Dior.
Well, there was a number of people that were interviewed, Nate Eaton, Frank Vilt, and all these people. These were a reporter, private investigator. There were friends of the family. There was a whole lot of people investigating. What was your general feeling at the end of that? Because there's so many people that were involved with this case.
There's been a lot of twists and turns in the road there. And the oddity is, Dior was very close to water. That was number one. Number two was in a wilderness area. Number three, canines that were brought there never picked up a scent of him leaving. And just above where Dior disappeared, there was a giant boulder field. So when you start to look at the elements involved, that's the reason we took it on. Now, in almost every one of the child cases that I've written about, where the child was never found, there's some point usually in there where law enforcement says, well, the people that were there, we've got to look at them. They're a possible suspect. And that's really an effort in futility expressed by law enforcement many of the times. Now, those people are never arrested 99.99% of the time, and nothing ever comes of it, which is kind of the way the New York Coontz case went.
Hey, you know, I want to tell you, you use a term called a point of separation, and you can delineate on that there. But you know what? I have found an application for that as well for truth seekers, David. I was talking with my service master rep, and we got to talking about all various things. This interview coming up, I said, hey, we're going to have David Pilatus on, and you need to watch the show, you know. And he's been kind of seeking truth himself in his own life, and it dawned on me that I wanted to know. We wanted to know. When was it that you started to search for truth, you know, rather than what the world presents as truth? And all of a sudden, it just came to me. The question should have been, what was your point of separation to be stuck in the system, to be told from the system in the corral of what the system says is this is fact? What was your point of separation to start following the truth? So if you don't mind, I kind of hijacked that. Is that all right? Because I had a point of separation in my own life where it's like my worldview got shocked. The world ain't like it's presented to me. And there was a point of separation in my life that got me led right up to this broadcast.
So there's a lot of people in this world that don't want to dive deep on topics. And you probably met them. And they have beliefs. They have a belief system that comes from a minute amount of knowledge. And really, if you take that deep dive on many subjects, you're going to be shocked that there's truth behind it. And when we first started looking into missing people, a lot of individuals attacked me wholeheartedly and said, oh, this is just complete crap. People can disappear in the mountains, you know, there's nothing to it. And then when I went to conferences, I put up this table of children that disappeared and how many miles away they were found. And before I put that table up, I would ask the parents in the audience, if your child disappeared in the middle of the woods on a trail, what would they do? Would they lay down and go to sleep? Would they play in the dirt? Would they run downhill, run uphill? How far would they go? And the general consensus was most of them said they'd lay down in the dirt, take a nap. Some said they'd run downhill for a while, get bored, and go to sleep. Very few ever said, oh, you know, they'd run uphill for 3,500 feet and for 10 miles. But you know what? The facts show that there's a lot of kids that are found way higher in elevation than where they were, that they traveled distances that you know and I know my kids would never travel in that amount of time and couldn't travel. And when you start to look at those things and you start to say, well, if they didn't do it on their own, how did they get there? And that really shuts down a lot of the naysayers because they don't have a good argument for that. Well, and to me, honest to God, I really don't care if people don't believe it, because I have yet to find anybody that's read the book series and said, Dave, there's nothing there. Everybody says, wow, there's a lot there.
And I would actually absolutely concur with that. When I was connecting with you to get this interview, I told you, we've watched your videos over and over. It's just, they're so well done. The documentaries are so well done, and they're so compelling. And I don't know, is that your brother that helped with the show? And I saw his name in there. It looked like your brother produces it or something?
So it's my son. He co-directed. Yeah. And my son co-directed the first one with Mike DeGrazier. Mm-hmm. And then Ben went on to school and was in school during the second one. So Mike directed the second one on his own.
Yeah, well, I'm like I said, they're so professionally done. You just have to watch. But you know, I get more out of just seeing the cases. I mean, to me, it's made me more aware of my surroundings. I like one of the people in the movie said that they're taught when they're looking for somebody, take one step forward, or no, 5 steps forward, and then look forward, backward, left, and right, and then take another 5 steps. But really, we should do that just in our normal every day. You just be aware of your surroundings, because one thing, I don't want to get snatched, David. And so hopefully, if people have kids, and I would say one thing, that if somebody does go into the forest, just based on the sheer amount of cases that you've come across, they need to keep an eye on their people. Now, let me ask them, how many, or is there a large percentage of people, say, going as a group through a trail or through a forest, and is it the person in the back that just seemingly disappears?
So almost 5 years ago, an individual named Roger Marsh, who was a writer, wrote an article saying, "Don't be last in line." It was in the Huffington Post. And he had read a couple of my books, and he understood that if you're a straggler, you're the person last in line, it seems like you're the one that's going to go missing. And it was a good article. But the real point is that I tell everybody, I go into the woods as much as anybody you know. And there's one thing I always do. I always carry a personal locator beacon. And that's a device where you activate it, sends a signal up to a satellite. You stay in that position, they'll call search and rescue, tell them your GPS, and they'll come look for you, and they'll find you within 10 feet. I tell people, if everyone carried one of those, I would hesitate to say that 90% of the cases I researched, the people would be found quickly and safely. And then for myself, probably because I'm trained in law enforcement, carry a gun every time I go in the woods. And there's a strange statistic that I have, that I do not have one case where a person was carrying a firearm and a personal locator beacon and disappeared. It's probably happened, and I don't know about it, but I've never been able to find one to date.
I don't know if you know this. There's a story just a couple days ago. A couple was hiking in the woods, and it got dark, and they fell down a ravine. And as they were falling through the trees, they kind of got stuck right on the very end of their fall. And they were 2 feet away from a cliff. They don't know. They were kind of dangling there. And what happened was they thought they were going to be – they didn't know what – it was dark. They were hanging on a leaf and a vine. They didn't know that death was like 2 feet away. They were just sitting there thinking what to do. The guys I watch said it – he didn't know this, but it flashed a signal. It said, "It looks like you have fallen. I will call 411 unless you click here." And he never didn't know what was going on. And his watch dialed 911, and he was rescued.
I read about that. That was amazing that Apple put that in the watch.
Yeah. Says, "It looks like you're falling." Wow. Who knew? His life was saved because of it. So we got to this. Now, this next, we're in sort of in the missing 411, the first one, Bobby Bissup, age 10, back in 58. Now, this might be a little problematic, that because that place known as Camp St. Malo has been in the news recently.
In fact, I wrote a big article about it on our website. It's the number one item under current events. So the Colorado Attorney General came out with a report earlier this week that identified 166 different priests in Colorado that had been a target of an investigation for abuse. And the weird thing is that Bobby was at a place called Camp St. Malo, right on the edge of the Rocky Mountain National Park. And in fact, the property line borders that, and it's owned by the Archdiocese of Denver. It was founded by a father named Bassetti, who just loved the outdoors. When the report came out, it named Bassetti as one of the people involved in an accusation. And then it named another father that was named in 18 different cases. Both of them had been running or had been involved in Camp St. Malo at one point or another. And I wrote that because I want to be transparent. All of the indications are that Bobby matched every one of those profile points. He was found the next summer by some counselors who were out looking for him. Where he was found, it is just totally baffling to everybody who was on that film crew. If you look above Camp St. Malo, there's a 12,000-foot peak called Meeker. And about three-quarters of the way up the peak is timberline. And then above that, it's just gravel and rocks. Well, it's just above timberline. In one of those gullies, they found his hearing aid and some of the other things belonging to Bob, which to us meant that he had to have died or had to have been placed way above that, and during the winter and spring, his remains, or some of those remains, were washed down to where they were found, which makes no sense at all. None. Because Bobby was a 10-year-old boy. The counselor came out to get him when he was fishing at a little creek behind the resort. He said, sure, a 10-year-old boy, time for dinner. You know kids are going to come and eat, especially a boy. And in the exact opposite direction, he would have had to have hiked 3 or 4 miles uphill away from the camp, upstream from where he was fishing. Even a 10-year-old knows the direction to camp from there. And he was never found. There was a massive search for that kid. And if you go to YouTube, Man Missing Project, there's a little video we made that specifically talks about Bobby. And you can see it. But it's one of those featured cases in that number one movie.
Back to that previous case, there's a person named Isaac who had a prior sex crime. And I know that some people would suggest, well, you know, if you've got, you know, if there's a child missing, I mean, most times they're going to automatically assume perhaps there's a molester somewhere around. And so it really, there may be in some cases, you know, there's a lot of missing kids. There's 500 missing kids out of the Child Protection Services in Arkansas, or in Arizona. And so, you know, kids are missing all the time. But this doesn't take away from those cases where way up in the woods or the mountains where you can't even get access to, where it takes hours to get through, loose rock. I mean, there's not people up there with kids, because by the time they're notified, they'd have to escape out of there by the time, because the search parties are on their way usually pretty quickly. So, you know, I wouldn't say to dismiss all cases like that. I mean, there's, besides that, there's adults missing. You in fact, most of yours of your investigations seem like they involve hunters. And of course, there's just hikers as well. Then we got the case of Jared Adadero, age 3. What happened with that back in the Comanche Park Wilderness?
So Jared was a little 3-year-old. His dad ran a resort about 20 miles from the Big South Trail in Colorado. And he was hosting a group of singles. And one of the singles people said, hey, can we take your daughter? Her daughter was 5 or 6 years old at the time. And she wants to go with us to the fish hatchery just up the road. Well, Jared, who was 3 at the time, says, hey, I want to go. So they went and asked Mr. Adadero, hey, can we take your son and daughter to the fish hatchery? And he said, sure. So the group goes to the fish hatchery, and unbeknownst to Mr. Adadero, they make a decision that they're going to drive 20 miles further up the road and take a hike on the Big South Trail. Now, they never tell Mr. Adadero they're going to take his kids, but they do. Well, the daughter ends up staying with a group of people. Jared, being rambunctious, takes off running down the trail. They lose sight of him. Well, the last known sighting of Jared alive involved two fishermen that were in the river, the Poudre River. And Jared walks up to him, and he's knocking a stick in the water. And he asks him, hey, are there any bear around here? And the fishermen say, no, there's no bear, but stop knocking on the stick and, you know, stay out of the water and just move away from us. They don't know what happened to Jared after that. And that's bothersome to me, that two adults in the middle of nowhere on a trail would allow a little 3-year-old to walk away from them. That's number one. And number two, the singles come back, they're looking for Jared, they can't find him. They send somebody back to the resort to tell Mr. Adadero they can't find him. But he's okay. They say, we can't find him, but he's okay. Mr. Adadero gets in a car and goes up there. They're calling search and rescue, Larimer County Sheriff's. That starts a whole series of a 10-day search for Jared. During the search, the Air Force sends a helicopter up there. The helicopter crashes. It's one of the most bizarre set of circumstances on a case I've ever seen. Make a long story short, 4 years later, Jared's skull cap, his pants, are found inside out 550 feet above the trail. shoes are found up there, and they find one tooth on top of a log. Right away, when I saw this skull cap, I said, something's really, really different about this. So I contacted Harvey Pratt, who was the assistant director of the Oklahoma Bureau of Investigation, and I sent him a series of photos of the skull cap. I said, Harvey, look at this. He said, whoa. What it is, it's a series of cut marks in the skull cap. And some of them are at 90 degrees to one another. It almost looks like somebody sat there and put cut marks in the skull and then turned it sideways to make them 90 degrees. I said, hey, can you send this to your forensic examiner? He's been doing this for 60 years. And ask him what he thinks. A couple days later, Harvey calls me back and says, Dave, he says in his entire career, 10,000 cases, he's never seen anything like that. Well, at the time, when they find the pants inside out, skull cap, the sheriff puts the pants right side out, puts it all on a board, has a big press conference, and says to the nation, Jared's been found, a mountain lion killed him. Well, they also found Jared's top, and they sent the pants and they sent the top to the Colorado Bureau of Investigation, and they couldn't find any blood on either one. So Mr. Adderdale said, this doesn't make any sense. So he finds four professional mountain lion people. He sends them all of this information. And they came back and they said, well, one thing we can guarantee, all of them independently, mountain lion didn't kill your son. Because it would go right through the abdomen and there would be blood all over that clothing. Now, mountain lion did not kill your son. So the mystery really, what put the striation marks in Jared's skull? And how did Jared get 550 feet above the trail where he approached those fishermen? The other part of the mystery is that Jared never tied his shoes, ever. So if a mountain lion or a bear had attacked him and drug him 550 feet up that hillside, his shoes never would have made it. Yet they were right there in that same area.
Tell you what, Dave, before we continue on, let's take a couple questions from our live chat viewers. Sibylla asked this question. Says, David, can you tell the story of the man that was hiking that apparently stepped through some sort of portal?
So I never identified it as a portal, but the story is that a hunter was hunting up at near 11,000 feet in Colorado, and he was walking through a meadow of grass. And as he came through the grass and was walking down the trail, he looked ahead of him, and he saw what almost looked like a fog bank or unusual-looking air in front of him down the trail, not too far. He said, you know, it's weird that I even looked up, because I was just kind of looking down, just trying to make my way someplace else on this trail. But as I got closer to this unusual, airy look, I stopped right in front of it. And he said that he picked up his foot, and he put his foot up to it, and part of his foot disappeared as it entered this area. And he said it scared the hell out of him, pulled his foot back, and turned and went the other direction as fast as he could. And I haven't heard many other stories like that, but it came from a pretty credible guy.
Wow, I mean, if that's legitimate, and let's just say that these type of areas exist, I would call them I call it a thin place. I mean, that could account for some of the absolute zero evidence disappearances. I noticed that you say that that in most disappearance cases, the gun is missing, the arrows, various things that people have with them aren't dragged off by and they're not blown away by the wind, and animals don't take them. Those are gone too as well. And I see questions are flying in here. I don't know. We have to kind of wait way back and forth here. Roxy says, David, has a member of the group having a disappearance ever reported seeing a suspicious anomaly in conjunction with that disappearance?
Never. I wish I could say that. I get that question all the time. And if there was ever anything seen in conjunction, I'd report it, I'd write about it. Because that would really give us some direction to go. A lot of people say, well, before Missing 411, The Hunted movie came out, a lot of people said, oh, you know, he doesn't even want to talk about the anomalies that are out there. And he really knows what's happening to these people, but he doesn't want to say it. And the hilarity behind that is, thousands of people have read the book series. Nobody has ever come forward to say they have this figured out. Now, in The Hunted movie, near the end, we did talk about some of the things that hunters have encountered in the woods that are unusual. And I made sure to say, this is no implication that this is what's happened to the hunters. But here's some weird things that have happened to them, happened to credible people, and we can back it up with science that it happened. And if it didn't happen, then the professors that did the research are lying, and that doesn't happen. So,
you mentioned a second ago about, we're talking about one of the missing children's cases, and you said that he was, seemed like placed back in a certain position, or his belongings were placed in a certain position. I noticed that in an interview with George Knapp, he said, he made a statement like, it's almost as if they were dropped into a certain area. And then in the Hunted video, you said, I think I wrote it down, that it appeared that they were placed back after multiple searches. You just casually said it is as if he was placed back in the original area after dozens of people have gone over the area. Being placed seems to indicate an intelligence of some kind that is making this move of the missing person or their effects or their remains.
So in my books, one of the profile points is the victim being found in an area where it was previously searched. And not searched once, sometimes searched 10 times. And then all of a sudden, in an area where the people had walked back and forth hundreds of times in mass, the victim's found exactly where they just were yesterday, deceased. Not an idiot. I do not believe that search and rescue and canines miss those people. I think that somehow or another, they were put back there. By what? By who? How? That's the million-dollar question, because a lot of times, searchers stay in the field overnight just under the happenstance that maybe the victim's alive and they can hear something at night, or they can call to him at night. And then in amongst all of this, the victim reappears, deceased, right near where they were all night. And how did they get in there? How wasn't something seen, heard? It's really, really mystical.
And that is really one of the intriguing parts of the series that you've produced about there's so many things that can be explained. And just let's say like ghost sightings or UFO sightings, the first thing you want to do is eliminate every possibility of what it could be. Is that UFO? Is it a light in the sky? Is it a helicopter? You know, you got to eliminate various things. But in fact, I think most of your cases, because you go through a rigorous process, it appears that before they ever hit the books or before they hit the DVD or movies, you've cleaned that out, that these things are not. They're not a mad parent. They're not this. They're not that. So people get from these audio, the books, they get the actual the most mysterious of all that cannot be explained in most cases.
So we go through a vetting process when we get a case. And we make sure that there's no criminal involvement, meaning that it's not somebody on a trail that attacks somebody else and kills them. We make sure that it's not animal predation. A lot of people say, oh, you know what, Pilatus is just doing this, and really it's just a case where a mountain lion killed this guy or a bear killed this guy. No. Because search and rescue has vetted that out. Search and rescue won't put a lot of people in there if there's a chance that there's a bear or a mountain lion in there. And when there's a bear or a mountain lion attack, it's a gruesome scene. Online on Google or Yahoo and put in animal predation or animal attack and see what you see. You got to be a complete idiot not to miss those scenes. They're gruesome, there's torn clothing, there's blood, and even if the animal drags you off, there's going to be drag marks leaving the area. So that's another step of the vetting. If a person has mental illness, is suicidal, wants to drop out of society, we won't look at it. So once we go through that vetting process and it has cleared all of those hurdles, then we'll start looking at the case. So you're right. You hear people saying, oh, it's just this, it's just that. They have no knowledge of the topic. They've never read a book. They don't understand what it goes through. So, yeah. We have the strangest of the strange.
In the second movie, Missing 411, The Hunted, you open up with sort of a list of categories, such as what is the consistency, point of separation, near water, can't track, and there's some usually a disability or illness, boulder fields, and that's what we talked about earlier about the boulder fields. It's an amazing connection there. Weather events. I want to talk to you on one particular case. We'll get to the opening of Thomas Messick, but you did an interview with Ron, or you went with Ron. Ron Moorhead appears on there, and I wanted to tell you, he tells a story in there about a mysterious event where they were all in the campsite and they heard all kind of ruckus going on right outside, and they thought for sure something was in the camp messing everything up. They looked out there and nothing was disturbed. And David, I got to tell you, that exact same thing happened to me. Me and a friend was camping years back. We were in a tent, turning in for the evening. All kind of ruckus was happening out there. I was like, crap, man, we got a bear in the campsite, you know. So it was like, you know, don't make a move, because we weren't armed. We have no way to take this thing on. It was big, whatever it was. It seemed like it was jumping on tables and stuff. Then it got quiet. We went out. Nothing was disturbed. Exactly like what happened to Ron Moorhead.
Where were you at?
I was in a campsite in Lake Lemon, Indiana.
So, yeah, our crew were invited by Ron to go up to this camp he has up in the mountains of California. And we went in by horseback for 8 miles. It's in the middle of nowhere. And this camp has had a series of things happen at it consistently to these hunters for decades. They first started going there in the late 40s. And then Ron had the smart idea, well, I'm going to bring a recorder in there. This was in the 70s, early 70s, before digital. And he recorded some of the sounds and things that they heard in camp. Now, if that happened today, I'm afraid that anybody with any amount of knowledge would discount it 100%, because I could fake it easily at this point. But in the 70s, you couldn't. And he sent it to some audiology professors who analyzed it. The sounds were outside the human spectrum, mm-hmm. couldn't have been made by a man. Mm-hmm. It didn't match any known animal in North America. The sounds they guesstimated came from something bigger than a man. Mm-hmm. I mean, it went on and on like this. But your story about what they heard, Ron, when we were there for a week, we went through this story a couple times. And Ron said, Dave, it sounded like something or a gang of thieves went through a kitchen, broke everything in the kitchen, banging pots together, and everything would have been destroyed. Mm-hmm. And they were in this shelter that they had built out of mm-hmm. logs. And so they were pretty well confined, and they couldn't see. He says another night they were there in camp, and he said, right up above me, I heard like a door open and close, like a car door. Well, you know, that's impossible, because I knew where we were. We were 8 miles from anywhere. Mm-hmm. And so there were some very, very strange things that happened to those guys over the decades.
By the way, I have to say, Dave, we took the 411 hunted and the other movie to the first one, camping, and my wife and I was out in the middle of nowhere watching your videos, because I got a big screen in my camper. And let me tell you something, that's not the movie to watch when you're out in the middle of the freaking forest, man. But it was fun as hell, I got to tell you. And it's probably my own mind, man, but we were walking through there. It was dark. We just watched your movie. Heard something in the forest. We're thinking, crap, where's Dave at, man? He'll know what to do. We ran real quick through the camper. But, hey, you know, hey, that just tells you the effect that movie has. And by those audio clips that you have on this film from Ron are absolutely shocking. I mean, it's like there's a conversation. And I thought I don't know if you heard this. This is just me. But some of those audio sounds to me like Indian talk. I mean, it sounds not the actual rah rah that they were going back and forth, but way low, I heard chatter. Did you hear that? If you listened to it real closely?
Yeah, in fact, I've had a group of people listen to it, and in fact, one of them's a Native American chief, and he never got that. The best explanation I had for this was, if you could imagine a couple of Japanese people sitting and talking extraordinarily fast, that's what the majority of people think it sounds like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it definitely is. It was a conversation or something. We got this question from Connecticut. It says, David, is there many cases in Connecticut or the East Coast?
Wrote an entire book about it, Missing 411 Eastern U.S. And let me say this now. Please do not go onto Amazon and buy my books. Amazon, we don't sell on Amazon. So you're going to see my books out there between $50 and maybe $95 each. Those are resellers trying to rip you off. Go to our website, canammissing.com. They're $25 a piece. Now, anyhow, the Eastern book is one of our first ones, predominantly just Eastern U.S. cases. And on the cluster map, all the way up and down the Appalachian Trail, going from south to north, there's a continuous line of missing cases that match our profile.
Yeah, and I believe you say the number one site is Yosemite?
Yosemite National Park.
I'm sorry. Yosemite.
Yeah, Yosemite, the biggest boulder fields in the world, the biggest amount of granite you'll find anywhere, and that's pretty coincidental that that's where the most missing people are.
And there you are with the boulders there, too. Are you sure that there's not something to do with the boulders, that maybe a doorway or something to that effect? Let's get another question. Somebody says, I'm up here in Alaska. Are there any? Now, it is Can-Am, but does Alaska have any cases?
Oh, yeah, absolutely sure does. I've written about some of the most amazing cases in Canada. Alaska. There's, in Missing 411 Law, which was my latest book, I talked about some air disappearances that are related to our work. And one of the most famous ones coming out of Alaska involved some legislators that disappeared and were never found. Wow. But even ground people in Alaska, hunters, hikers, that just vanished completely and left behind things that are mysterious, like clothing and shoes. It's weird.
Mm. That is interesting about sometimes the clothes are folded. Is that right?
A couple of strange cases where they found their clothes folded on a boulder in the middle of a river.
How do you explain that?
How do you even come close to explaining that?
And I like that one story where the hiker is missing, and then within view of a road and a house, there appears to be a setup of like a backpack and a energy drinks in there, as if somebody sat there. The person who those belongings belong to was viewing that. How's that explained?
So that was a hunter that disappeared, and way back up in the mountains, they found his boots next to a fire he tried to make. Search and rescue was looking for him at that time, and it snowed a couple feet. So as they're coming up, they don't see any tracks going out. So they figure he's got to be up there. They've kind of got him in this position where he can't go anywhere. Well, then the searchers find his boots next to this campfire. And the sheriff said, well, geez, he's got to have hypothermia at this point. He's within a couple hundred yards of here. So they just comb the area. They don't find anything. A year and a half later, 6 air miles downhill from where he was, they find this thermos sitting up on a rock. They find this guy's backpack leaning against a tree, and there's food in the backpack, and there's a .44 Ruger that's loaded in the backpack. One of the things I tell hunters when I talk to them is, a lot of times in hunter safety classes they aren't teaching this, and I don't know why, but always make sure you're carrying about 20 rounds when you go hunting. And here's why. Because if you're lost in the woods and you've got a firearm with you, hold your position and fire off 3 rounds rapidly. And that means that somebody needs help. And then about every hour, fire off another 3 rounds. And that will allow the people that are around you to slowly figure out exactly where you are. Well, this guy had never been fired. And here's this guy in an area where the searcher said it would have been impossible for him to walk out of the area he was in bare feet and make it that far.
I'm going to, I don't know if you can see this. I've got a clip here that is in your trailer. And it is where you ask a somebody, I think maybe from the Department of Parks or something. I'm not sure what it is. But you ask him a question, is there a list? And I saw that question come in earlier, too. Somebody wanted to know, is there a list kept by the Park Service? But when you ask him the question, Dave, did you notice his expression at the end of it? I'm going to play it. I don't know if you can see it. You'll probably remember it. And if the folks here can see the expression, I want everybody to look at the expression on his face when you ask that question. Here we go.
Does the National Park Service keep a list of missing people in their parks?
I'm going to play it one more time.
Does the National Park Service keep a list of missing people in their parks?
All right. Were you able to see that, Dave?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. He is like, he's shocked. He blinks. He takes a gasp of air. It's like he wasn't programmed to answer that question. And I thought that was so telling.
And that's, I hope that a lot of people caught that. And that's one of the reasons it was in that movie. That was Ken Salazar. He was the former head of the Department of the Interior. And if there's anybody in the world that should know there's a list of missing people, mm-hmm. it would be him. And we met with him in his offices. He's an attorney now in Denver. And he was not happy with that question later.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, he told all of us to put our phones down in one location, and he marched us into another room and specifically talked to us. He was not happy.
Wow. Wow. I see somebody in the live chat said, I noticed the same thing when I watched it. So it looks like other people noticed that. And the reason that gets noticed is because the videos by themselves are so compelling, you really don't want to look away, and you're kind of, you know, it's so much information coming to you, it's so shocking, it's like, wow, you know, I've got to watch this again. Question come in, it says, did you ever get a list?
No. They came back and they said, we don't have a list. But if you want a list from our system, that's going to cost you $1.4 million.
Wow. Okay.
Wow. And so we really got upset, and this was starting maybe 8-9 years ago now. We put our head to the grindstone and just started plugging away and got to where we are today, about 1,200 cases. I can guarantee we haven't even scratched the surface on the majority of them yet, because it's very hard in some jurisdictions to find the information because the searches aren't covered in news organizations.
Wow. I'm going to play a clip here again. It is in the movie The Hunted, and it's interesting that this segment appears not to be connected to missing, but yet you put it in there, and I thought that was fascinating and such an interesting thing. It's about a lady who's hunting. You know which case I'm talking about. Just a little video here. I don't know if folks can see it, but you did a good job in the effects of a what appears to be a predator in a tree. Let me see if I can play that real quick. We tried to zoom in on a little bit. Let's see if we can get it. But that is an excellent rendition of what appears to be an entity of some type. David, why did you put that in the video?
So I think it's important that we not shy away from looking for the truth. In this instance, this person was in a deer hunting stand, and they saw something across from them, and they had a camera in their hand. And there was almost some missing time for this female bow hunter. But she took a picture, and that picture was later analyzed by her husband, who was a physicist, an optical physicist. And he called Verizon because he was looking at the pixelization of the photo and noticed, I don't think that camera can do that. And so we called Verizon, and Verizon said, well, that camera took that picture, but that camera can't take that picture. And the reason being is that the hardware and the software in the camera could not have taken that pixel numeration that was found in that photograph. And that coupled with, at the same time she's making that observation, she had a nephew 2 miles away that was at band practice at a local high school. And as they're on the field, they look up and they see this bright white ball hovering above their band practice. This is simultaneous to which, and he gets off the field, he calls his uncle, that's this woman's husband, says, you won't believe what we just saw, uncle. And then 20 minutes later, she comes in and says, explains kind of what happened later on. It's a, it's in the movie because, number one, something unusual happened to that camera when she took that picture. So there's physical proof something unusual happened. Number two, her nephew 2 miles away simultaneously, and he's interviewed, says something strange happened. And then her experience, number three, if somebody just said something to me, I'm not going to demean them. I'm not going to say, oh, that didn't happen. But in the cases that we put in the movie, there's physical evidence something really strange happened. Without the physical evidence, it doesn't make the movie.
And I really applaud you for that. I just thought it just fit perfectly. You think, you know, I mean, it takes a master storyteller to inject that story in there with the course of the way the video's going, and it just played perfectly in there. But I noticed that if you look at it that way, the anomaly that was over the foot of the band practice, some yards away, hundreds of yards away, whatever, I don't know what the exact distance, what was the distance, do you know? Half a mile?
2 miles.
What was it?
2 miles.
Okay, and then when Ron Moorhead was talking about rods flying through the campsite and blue balls and that noise, it seems, and some of the other interviews that I've done, that we were sort of getting into the paranormal, which I don't think is a bad word. It is just not normal. It's not the normal way of looking at things. But there seems to be a mystical part of something mysterious. I guess we could use the word. But there's other things that are going on. So in those two cases, they both describe other events that are going on. And so in the most mysterious cases that you've come across, there's nothing else. Have you found anything else going on? Do you, when you investigate a case, is your spiritual sense like on fire, like absolutely tuned to look around to see if something other than, you know, let's look for evidence on the ground, but maybe something's over there, maybe something's over there, maybe something's happening. Do you get that feeling?
You know, when we were up at Moorhead's hunting camp, nothing happened really, which was odd. But I try to go to as many locations where these people go missing as I can so I can get a feeling for what the physical site is like and the circumstances, and so I can better understand it. So, and all of the times I've been into these places, I've never had anything unusual happen to me. I've never felt strange. Maybe it's just me. But.
Well, now listen, man. Don't feel bad, because when George Knapp went to Skinwalker Ranch, they literally used him as bait, and he's interviewed all these people, these absolute straight line guys, man, saying we seen this, we got this, this on film, our camera's destroyed here, holes blown up here, things come out of portals. And so he has all these stories, and they put him as bait to get one of these things activate. He spent the whole night in his room, man, and nothing happened. And so, you know, but he does a great video on it, but nothing happened to him. And, you know, I don't know if he really wanted anything to happen to him, but they did use him as bait. So, you know, even if you placed yourself out there, just say Ron and the guys weren't there and you were left alone, it's not likely something would happen to you, because maybe only, I don't know, some reason certain people get to see stuff. I wouldn't worry about it. Maybe you don't want to know. Okay.
Well, if my producers or directors are watching this, don't get any ideas from this.
I think they should. I think they should put you out there. Hey, say, you know what? Next movie, we're going to set Dave out in the middle of the forest, and then we're going to, you know, we'll leave him alone for 3 days, and then, you know, no light or anything, you know, man. Good luck with that. Let me know how that works out. Hey, so we got, all right, more, let's get another quick question in. It says, is it possible that some people are getting taken underground or inner earth?
So I get asked that question all the time, and you've got to think about it logically. So first of all, if they were taken underground, how is that happening without someone hearing, seeing, or physically watching it happening? Because if you read the books, you would see the parents say, my son or daughter was right next to me. Mm-hmm. 1 second. The next second, they're gone. Now, if people don't know this, I'll tell them that in national parks, you can't dig in the ground. You can't mine in a national park. You can't excavate in a national park unless you have a special archaeological permit. So, yeah, people say, well, why don't you bring in some ground-penetrating radar and figure this out? Well, because you need a permit from the Park Service, and they're never going to allow it. Mm-hmm. And in the areas like Yosemite, where there's so much granite and boulders, there's not a lot of dirt, open dirt per se. It's mostly rock.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We were talking about Ron Moorhead's secret camp, but that's in close proximity to Donnell Vista, where, well, at least three people disappeared. Can you tell us about that?
So let me ask you, what's one of the predominant things you saw in the movie at that Donnell Vista? A lot of rock, huh?
A lot of rock. Yeah, I was thinking, man, you know, like they're looking over the, it's an overlook. You look over, you're dead, man. You're going to disappear into nothingness there, it looks like to me. So, yeah, there are rocks, I mean, just boulders everywhere in that section of the video.
Tons of granite, and there's a lake down at the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been three people that have disappeared there, I think, within 12 or 15 years. No evidence, no sign, no nothing. And that's really within pretty close proximity of where Ron's camp was located. We put that in the movie, and we actually went out and interviewed one of the reporters in Sonora that had been covering that story for a long time. And I mean, people need to go watch Missing 411, The Hunted, and figure it out and say, hey, you know what? I don't speak a lot and give a lot of opinion in this because I allow the law enforcement people that we interviewed to do the talking or the reporters. Because those people were there. They've got their own set of ideas and thoughts and strangeness. A couple of them said, hey, when we were out there, we didn't even hear or see any animals, which was weird.
Mm-hmm.
And in an area where hunters were located, they didn't see any for a week.
Hmm. Well, Dave, you just described exactly what the lady said that saw the predator when she was hunting up in her tree stand. She said the forest went absolutely quiet. No bugs, no nothing, no birds, no animals of any kind. That seems to be, I wonder, in your list that you've constructed there, point of separation, near water, canines can't track, boulder fields, weather vents, unknown cause of death, geographical clustering. I wonder if you should put in there animals mysteriously not present, birds chirping not present. I mean, should that be included in that list?
I don't know. Maybe, maybe not. I think that's something, a lot of people go into the woods and they just think they aren't going to see or hear animals.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know. But if you're going into an area that you've hunted for many, many years and you don't see any animals at all, that's mm-hmm. weird.
Mm. Dreamwalker says, David, in The Hunted, he asks the question, who is doing the hunting?
Well, that's the million-dollar question. Read the books. I want you to come on the air with me and tell me.
And that is the great unknown. And but, you know, you're bringing to light this whole situation of missing people. You would think there would be more of an interest, say, from maybe a governmental standpoint. But, you know, there could be some hope in that. You know, recently the Navy just released the Tic Tac videos that show UFOs in the air. It's almost like soft disclosure after years of saying everybody who saw something in the sky was a conspiracy theorist. Obviously, you've been called a conspiracy theorist, you know, saying, well, you know, like you said earlier in the first hour, you know, people say, well, you know, people are getting abducted, and that's just the way it is. Now, there is in the United States a large and growing sex trafficking phenomenon going on. People get caught about that all the time. And, you know, it's a worldwide thing. And, of course, a lot of that, it could account for some number of it, but not, you know, again, it doesn't account for the grown men, for instance, the case of Thomas Messick. I mean, he didn't fit that category there. And why don't you tell us a little bit about Thomas Messick?
Let me step back a little bit, and not to be disrespectful, but I'm the farthest thing from a conspiracy person.
Right.
I don't promote any theory. I just present facts. Mm-hmm. So the person that calls me a conspiracy theorist, I'll pin him to the wall, and they better justify that statement. Because
mm-hmm.
I've made it my life's work to present facts on issues to people.
Mm-hmm.
And let others come up with a theory. And until I have a fact that points to what's happening, I'm not going to say it.
Yeah.
I have no facts right now.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons I really appreciate your videos, because, again, you don't speculate. You are so straight on the facts that I don't know how that would even come up in a conversation where somebody would say that, you know, in that way. But, yeah, you definitely have done your homework, and there's you don't go into speculation. But like I say, I can.
So you said something earlier that the government may not be interested. See, I think that's not true. In my earlier books, in Missing 411 Eastern U.S., I talk about how a series of FBI agents started showing up on missing cases years ago, decades ago. And they would say, hey, we're not here to investigate, we're just here to monitor. And that's a moniker term for the FBI writing reports.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
They wrote the reports, and they send them into their profiling unit in Virginia. And those people try to find matching cases to the cases that were written about and presented. Now, son of a gun, in the middle of nowhere in New York, an old man, 80-something-year-old man, Tom Messick, disappears. And the second day he's gone, two FBI agents show up? Why? FBI does not investigate missing adults. That's not part of their protocol, mm-hmm. not their job. And if anybody's been following the news, gee, the FBI says they're really busy with national crime and terrorism, but they sent two FBI agents up for multiple days
mm-hmm.
to monitor what's going on with Tom Messick. How weird is that? And I say it straight up in the movie. And I asked one of the commanders on the search and rescue while they were there. They didn't even know.
The plot thickens, but yeah, that is interesting there. He was armed, wasn't he?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
And his gun wasn't, you know, was somebody going to sneak up on you and take you when you're standing there with a loaded rifle? I don't. It's kind of go back to Ron Moorhead when in that section of video where the audio specialist that was with him said, "Who's going to make sounds in the middle of a forest, deep up in the Sierras, you know, and try to put voices out there to trick the people when you have a bunch of hunters there who sleep with their guns loaded? Nobody's going to do that." And I wouldn't sneak up on somebody with a gun, and he was sitting there with a gun.
Exactly. And that when you start to put some common sense behind it, nobody in any rational mind would do that. And why would anybody sneak up on Tom Messick, an old man? There were four older men spaced out evenly, maybe 75 to 100 yards apart.
Mm-hmm.
And the young men were driving deer down from the top of the mountain towards them. Well, they didn't drive any deer. They didn't see any deer. One of the men, when we interviewed him, I always ask this question to whoever I interview. I said, "Well, anything unusual or strange happen in the woods?" So the guy looks at me and he goes, "Yeah, heard this strange sound." And I said, I kept pushing him on that because he didn't mm-hmm. find the words to explain what it was. In the end, he said, it was almost like a giant clack, two pieces of metal coming together. And that was during the time that all these guys were sitting, they weren't moving, waiting for animals to come towards him.
Mm-hmm.
He got up, and they all went back to their cars. Tom didn't come back. It was during that time, he goes, "Dave, I've been a hunter for 50 years. I've never heard that noise in the woods. But I did this time, and Messick disappears that time." It's kind of strange.
Mm. I want to, and in fact, I'd like to suggest this again, because I got the hat. Remember, I told you first hour, I can go crazy. I can speculate. But is it possible?
Oh, yeah.
And I'll let you borrow my hat one day just to let Lou say, "You know, I'm going to go crazy tonight." But I know that's not your style. But anyway, is it possible that noise he heard was a boulder opening up and closing against another boulder because something was big enough and strong enough to open that as sort of a layer or entry point to somewhere else.
I've never heard that theory, but I like it. Sounds interesting.
Right, yeah.
But if that was the case, then Canine should have been able to track Tom from that position to wherever the boulder opened.
Did you have to hit me with logic? I was doing really good there. I was doing really good, Dave. I'm going to edit that part out, man. I'm going to say, that's a really good theory, and I'm going to cut it right there. I'll say, thank you. But no, so, and that is interesting, too. You talk about mysterious. Canines can't find you? Are you kidding me? They can't pick up a scent? And that's what they're trained to do? Criminals can't get away from that. How is it people can get away? That is indeed a mystery.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the strongest parts of the entire profile points to me, because I worked on a SWAT team in the police department, and we had the canine unit attached to us, so we would train together all the time. And whenever those dogs were put on somebody's scent, I can never remember them laying down, being afraid to go in, anything. They were always so eager to track anybody that when a dog acts like that, it's very abnormal.
A lot of people have been involved in searches for these missing people. Have you talked to the searchers and kind of gathered their opinion of the absolute lack of evidence? I mean, has anybody said, I've never seen anything like this, this doesn't make any sense, among the searchers that you've talked to?
Well, yeah, there were a couple of them in the Hunted movie. I mean, there was a sheriff up in Montana that essentially said it makes no sense, Dave. And then we had another searcher in New York say, yeah, we didn't find anything. We should have found something. This doesn't follow. When somebody goes missing, they usually start dropping things because they're getting tired. You know, you're going to find a rifle because animals are never going to move that.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to find a coat because animals aren't interested in coats. But they never find anything on these people, which is odd.
Of all the cases, is there one that shocked you? That when you think about it, that you're still shocked today? You don't have to come up with on the spot like this, but can you think of any that just absolutely, you've seen so many, and then bam, you get hit with this, and you're going, I can't believe it. Is there any case like that?
So I'm not trying to evade the question, but truthfully, when you go on scene, and you listen to the search and rescue people,
mm-hmm.
It's almost a cookie cutter every time you go. It's almost the same kind of thing each time. That's the reason they're in the books, because these profile points match. But when you go in there and you sit across from the searchers and you hear them say, yeah, we put dogs in there. Dogs didn't pick up a scent. Yeah, I was there for a week and I didn't see any squirrels. I didn't see anything that was alive.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes, yeah, that was odd. When you hear those kind of things coming from them that was on scene, there's some people in search and rescue that are so afraid of saying anything outside the norm that I feel sorry for those people. Because from watching the Hunted movie, people are going to understand that, and these people were straight up front with the search and rescue people.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't, I really respect their obvious candor and concern for what they were doing, because they knew it didn't make sense.
Mm. Wow. You know, when you say profile points, to me, that it is almost like a key that unlocks a door, sort of in the Twilight Zone sense, that if these conditions exist, there is a high probability that something could happen or has happened that we don't know about yet. But if there is a methodology, then that means there's an intelligence involved, Dave.
I agree, for sure.
Well, that sure is something to think about. Let's move on to the case of Fred Drum, age 68, out at in the area of Schuylerville, New York. What happened out there?
So, as the searchers are on the scene in the Adirondacks on this old hunter that disappeared. Days after he disappeared, in Schleyerville, New York, Fred Drum disappears. And he owns a piece of property in a rural part of New York, kind of a rancher farmer kind of guy. And he goes out to check on some things. He disappears on his property. It's even more bizarre because it's a more confined area. There's a river that runs along the backside of his property, so there's water. It's a pretty open area. He's in his 70s. He's another older man. Any thought that he was washed away or any thought that there was a criminal element or any chance that he was suicidal, all those things are not true. So it's strange that it happened in both geographical proximity and time proximity to the first case. And that's the reason we covered it. And the similarities are pretty close. The only difference, Fred was a hunter, but he wasn't hunting at the time.
And we have the case of Audrey Kaplan. It looked like they were hiking. So here you have hikers, not hunters.
So Kaplan's case is different, and it'll probably confuse people to talk about it, so I probably not want to go into that too deep.
Okay.
It's different.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Melvin Nadell, these are just random cases from the hunted.
Nadell is one of those guys where I say straight up in the hunter's book, Missing 411 Hunters, that bow hunters disappear at a higher rate than rifle and pistol hunters.
Wow.
And he was a bow hunter. He's with a group of friends, and he goes, hey, I'm going to walk right down the trail right there and go behind that tree 100 yards away, build my blind. He had a knee injury, wasn't going to go far. He carried a pistol, and he carried a bow. Mm-hmm. And he said, I'll be back in 3 or 4 hours. He never came back. The guys walked down to that blind. Nothing there. Massive search. Remember, he wasn't going to go far. He wasn't a good hiker. If he would have shot something, he would have waited it out, got more friends, and then would have went out and looked for the elk. Massive search. That's actually a geographical cluster zone of missing people. Mm. It's happened in New Mexico. Mel was never found. He should have been found. And when you see the interview with one of the guides that works that area and then with his wife, you'll be stunned.
Wow. We got another question. Let's interject this. Raul asked the question. Says, David, what are some of the results from autopsies of people that died that were found?
It's a great question. And one of the profile points is unknown cause of death. Several years ago when I pinned this and I started to talk about it, my son was playing ice hockey at Miami University and they had a game on the East Coast. And I was called by a coroner. And they said, hey, we want to meet with you. So I met with this person and they said, you know, you're the first person to ever write about this. But it's something we all know that's going on that's very strange. And we, as people of science, should be able to figure out why someone dies. And when we can't, something really, really unusual is happening that's beyond our grip. Mm. And it's bothersome. But that person tried to get me to talk in front of the National Association of Medical Examiners because of the evidence behind this. And it's something that isn't in just one area of the country. This happens in a lot of areas. And people would be surprised how many times somebody falls over dead under the circumstances that we're talking about, and they can't figure out why the person died. Now, throw out something that first time I heard it, kind of took me aback, and they said, well, Dave, this is somebody who had never read my books, but maybe came from your area of the world and was very spiritual and kind of believed in ghosts and paranormal stuff, and they said, well, Dave, somebody took their soul. That's why they died.
Wow. Well, Dave, you know, it sounds like you've dealt with a lot of sad cases. You said in the first hour that you kind of wear your heart on your sleeve. And, do you stay in touch with any of the people that of cases that you've relatives of cases you've investigated, or do you disconnect, or I mean, what's kind of the after view of that?
You know, I kind of let the family decide how much contact they want, and everybody grieves in their own way. Mm-hmm. And I would tell your audience that just because somebody grieves in a way that you don't understand, that doesn't mean that they're guilty of anything. Mm-hmm. Because everybody does it in their own way. Some people like to be left alone, don't want to talk about it. Other people want to talk about it. And there's quite a few families that I've covered that I still talk to all the time. I talked to one last night. And so I have deep compassion for these people, because in my world, the worst thing that can happen is for you to lose a loved one and to never understand what happened or where they are.
Well, obviously, it's awesome that you're actually out there trying to seek answers, and maybe the more investigations you do, more cases you study, the closer to the answer that maybe we'll get. Dave, I appreciate you giving up your Saturday night to come on the show with us. I know it's not your normal way, and really, I am just thrilled that you did that. I'm honored that you did. But tell the folks how they can get your books or your movies.
So the easiest way is to go to our website, Can-Am, like CanadianAmericanMissing.com. That's our website. Same thing, Can-Am Missing Project on YouTube to watch. I'm on Facebook at David Politis at Missing 411. Be careful on Facebook. There's a couple of sites that even have a picture of me. That is not me. Picture of me in some books. That is not me. That's a fraud site. There's a lot of people doing this, but yeah, you can get a hold of me. And if you ever want to write to me, I always tell people I'm an open book. You can write to me at missing411 at yahoo.com. I get a lot of emails every day. I'll get to you eventually. But I encourage people, and I always say this, that in the movies and in the books, we've probably covered about 1 to 2% of the total content. I mean, in the movies and the specials I've done for the History Channel, maybe 1 or 2% of the content that you'll see in the books. In the books, we have tables, lists, graphs, and we go into much more detail. And because of that, I can honestly say maybe 100 people in the last 5 years have written to me and said, you know, I never liked reading, and I got away from reading, and started reading your books, and I like reading again. So that really made me feel good, because I'm not a very good writer, but my stories are good. But,
yes.
You know, keep your ears and your eyes open. Keep an open mind on life, and don't believe a lot of naysayers on a topic. Don't let your mind be made up on something just because you read a blip about it on the news. Do your own research and dig deep.
Good words of advice. Dave, when you come out with another movie, I don't know that you are, but I'm just saying that you will. Can we have you back on the program again?
Absolutely. I'd love to.
All right. I appreciate you coming on and staying and doing this Saturday night. I really appreciate it, Dave.
Hey, thanks for being on the show. I appreciate it.
All right. Good evening.
Night.